I don't mind knife boys staring hard if it satisfies their desires. That's a shocking song from 1911. I'm going to talk, first of all, about what respectability is, and more specifically, what it meant for the different social groups in early 20th century Britain. And I'll have a little difficulty because almost everything written about respectability is written about Victorian times, whereas actually I'm interested in a little bit later. Secondly, I'm going to be looking at the generally successful campaign for respectability in the music hall in the first 20 years of the 20th century and slightly before, that is to say, in the late period of music hall, where the music hall is carried out in big theatres, 1,000 or 3,000 seats. It's no longer the small pub-like atmosphere, and where normally people are no longer drinking during the performance. And finally, I will compare briefly the campaign for respectability in Edwardian England with the campaign against antisocial behaviour in Britain today, and hopefully that way justify the fact that I'm talking about music hall in this workshop. So what was respectability for the Victorians and the Edwardians? Well, the first thing is it's very much a British concept, or perhaps an Anglophone concept, and if you search on Google for respectable working class, in quotations, you get 44,000 web pages. And if you search for classe ouvrière respectable, you get 42. Okay, so it's fairly clear of which half of them are talking about Britain. So it's fairly clear that it's very much integrated into something which is very, very British. Now, we have difficulties understanding what exactly it is. First of all, for a number of reasons. The first reason is it is a concept which was very much taken for granted. And commentators at the time will never define it because it goes without saying, and in particular they often write as if there was a very clear-cut and indisputable division between respectable people and non-respectable people, in particular when you're talking about the working class. So it was no problem for the writers of the time, there were the respectable and the non-respectable, and there was no debate to be had. And as Peter Bailey, the expert in Victorian music hall, says, many historians today have followed this problematic idea. Yes, that it goes without saying. So that our first problem is it was taken for granted. Second problem is that respectability is a vague concept. Now, in fact, the very vagueness of the concept of responsibility was part of its function. From the point of view of an individual person outside the established elite, respectability was never definitively gained. It could always be lost again or called into question. We could compare this with other concepts of moral regulation in other societies, for example, godliness in more religious societies, or in a modern context, if you're an immigrant, are you an integrated immigrant or not? Integration, you've never quite won it. So it's second difficulty. Third difficulty is that respectability is a concept constantly negotiated and renegotiated, and further, which evolves all the time. Large sections of the population were concerned in debating, defining and redefining the idea of respectability, and also Victorian respectability fades into Edwardian respectability, which fades into the next one. And it's very difficult when you've got a photograph to really pin it down. Nevertheless, we're obliged to try to define it, because you know, that's our job. And I'm going to start off with Peter Bailey's definition of respectability as, this is quote number one on your sheet, a highly specific value system of considerable normative power, whose most important consequence was to incorporate a minor but significant sector of the working class into the social consensus that assured mid-Victorian society, in particular, its overall cohesion and stability. And the comment I would add that is that the minor but significant sector of the working class in mid-Victorian times, my very strong impression is that by Edwardian times you're not talking about a small minority at all, but something which has become much more powerful and accepted, although also has changed in the process. Another historian specialised in the Victorian age, Geoffrey Bester, he wrote Mid-Victorian Britain before turning to a biography of Churchill, for a change. He is the author of quote number two. Respectability exerted a socially soothing tendency by assimilating the most widely separated groups, separated socially or geographically, to a common cult. So a very strong word there, cult. In this way, says Best, the division between respectable and not respectable could loom much larger than other differences between the rich and the poor, between employer and employee. That is to say that respectability ideology would normally function as a brake, for example, on the development of working class class consciousness. Certainly, one of the things which respectability ideology does, to use a more modern vocabulary, is to construct the denigrated other. The scapegoat who we are not and somebody else is. And this denigrated other in popular neighbourhoods was the person with no class or not respectable. And as we will see in the musical, the denigrated other was the vulgar performer. Now, respectability is a less aristocratic ideology than the ideology of deference, which is in slow decline in this period, but that's because, in principle, anybody can become respectable, rich or poor. And so it's not as fixed hierarchically as deference, which is accepting your fixed place in the social hierarchy. What else can we say about respectability at the time? Certainly respectability was negotiable, and the view that I've just explained of respectability as unambiguously an effective force for social stability has been contested by some writers, and some of them have emphasised that the accepting of respectability at the time did not stop working people from having radical ideas. According to Brian Harrison, the author of The Transformation of British Politics After 1860, working people who believed in respectability were, and I quote, far from deferential rubber stamps for its predominantly middle-class values. Rather, they generated their own independent convictions that gave them confidence to criticise the existing social order on other issues. So this is a slightly different view, some historians saying that it wasn't holding people so strongly. And Bailey goes on to say, we need to note the tenuous hold of the normative sanctions of respectability. Certainly, it seems to me that respectability works on a very long time framework. It's like it's there for 50, 60, 100 years, whereas the consciousness of a need for class conflict is something that tends to go up and right down and right up and right down within a few years. And so we have two different time scales going on, and I think that's something I'd like to look at more. Respectability was occasionally contested at the time, not often. I have two quotes for you on the sheet. One is Bertrand Russell, as we know, somebody who was prepared to stand very much outside the consensus. I mean, he was in prison during the First World War for opposing the war, so he was a very exceptional intellectual, because 99% of the intellectuals supported the war, whether they were left-wing, right-wing, or in the centre. And this is what he says: the same social struggle in varying forms runs through all classes except the very highest and the very lowest. There's not the struggle for social respectability. For this purpose, men and women make great moral efforts and show amazing powers of self-control. But all their efforts and all their self-control, being not used for any creative end, serve merely to dry up the wellspring of life within them, to make them feeble, listless, and trivial. It is not in such soil that the passion which produces genius can be nourished. Men's souls have exchanged the wilderness for the drawing room. They have become cramped and pretty and deformed, like Chinese women's feet. Even the horrors of war have hardly awakened them from the smug somnambulism of respectability. And it is chiefly the worship of money that has brought about this death-like slumber of all that makes men great. That's Bertrand Russell writing in 1916. Sometime earlier, somebody who were perhaps less surprised to see criticised respectability, Friedrich Engels, working in Manchester at the time. Quote 4, the most repulsive thing here in England is the bourgeois respectability which has grown deep into the bones of the workers. Even Tom Mann, who I regard as the best of the lot, is fond of mentioning that he will be lunching with the Lord Mayor. If one compares this with the French, one realises what a revolution is good for, after all. Okay, so I've looked there at respectability as a general social ideology, and very, very widely accepted, except for a few off left field people. What did it look like on an everyday level? Because respectability is something very complicated, something that you live through every day, as well as something you believe in abstractly. Well, firstly, among the elites, very often respectability could be mixed up with etiquette. As social mobility became a possibility, with industry and commerce developing, established elite groups developed more and more complex rules of etiquette to ensure the maintenance of class image barriers. And you have an extract on quote 5 from a book from 1886, Rules and Usages of the Best Society. And I hope you will be following this advice tonight for the impressive dinner. Greediness should not be indulged in. Indecision must be avoided. Do not take up one piece and lay it down in favour of another, or hesitate. Never allow a servant to fill your glass with wine that you do not wish to drink. I suppose that's conceivable. You can check him by touching the rim of your glass. Bread is broken at dinner. Never use a napkin in place of a handkerchief for wiping the forehead, face or nose. This is accompanied by a whole series of new traditions at the end of the 19th century, like calling cards. I have my calling card here somewhere. And a very, very complex ritual whereby if you fold down the top right-hand corner, that means that your card was not sent by a servant. And if you fold down the one corner of the card, it means that you're addressing yourself to all the ladies of the household. Well, I can give you the details if you need them later on, but just to say how detailed respectability could be for the elites. But of course, respectability was also extremely important for the dominated classes. Whether in the town or the countryside, the idea of respectability seemed to reign supreme. It wasn't always clear where deference had left off and respectability had come in. In her well-known semi-autobiographical novels, Lock, Rise to Candleford, Flora Thompson emphasises the importance of social hierarchy, respectable ordinary people in the villages as late as 1890.